The moon was a ghost, drifting through the treetops when Gus finally struck wood. The gas lanterns hissed and sputtered, embedding a shifting circle of brightness in the dark of the forest. Judy was kneeling by the edge of the hole, her eyes closed, sitting on her heels. I didn't know if she was praying or sleeping. I could barely see the heads of the men in the pit. Tom came and stood next to me. He held Heinrich's rubbing of the alien's face. Hans, I reminded myself, not the alien, but Johann Stern, a person. Someone who died a long time ago, far from home, in the company of strangers. What had he felt near the end, when all hope had been lost? What emotions had washed through that alien mind? Did my question even mean anything? Did strange enzymes coursing his blood play the role of adrenaline? Had he even had blood? Tom pointed to the sky. Full moon, he said. Wrong time to dig up Dracula's grave. He tried to smile to show that he was joking. I tried to smile to show him that I knew. I shivered. It was cooler in the mountains than I had thought it would be. Sepp called out, and we all jerked like puppets. Judy came suddenly alert and leaned forward over the pit. Tom and I walked to the edge of the hole and looked in. Sepp and Gus were standing to one side, while Heinrich probed in the clay with a trowel. There was something shiny and smooth protruding from the earth, pale, not bone white, but yellow and brown. He excavated around it and removed it, earth and all. Then he sat back on his haunches and scraped at it with a putty knife, cleaning it, his own face set as solidly as any carved in stone. He knows, I thought. A face emerged gradually from the embrace of the clay. Gus gasped and dropped his shovel. He crossed himself hastily three times. Sepp remained calm, watching with narrowed eyes. He nodded solemnly, as if he had always known the soil of Eiffelheim would yield unearthly fruit. It was a skull, and not a skull, and no earthly mind had ever sat within it. Soil chemistry had been at work on it, but our worms and bacteria had, for the most part, found it unappetizing. The eyes were gone, of course, and two enormous sockets set on either side of the head gaped empty. But whatever had served him for skin was still largely intact. It was a mummy's head. Heinrich held it out, and Judy took it gingerly. Tom stood behind her, inspecting it over her shoulder. Heinrich climbed from the pit and sat on its edge with his feet dangling in the hole. He took his pipe from his pocket and lit it, though I noticed his hands trembled a bit with the match.
So, Anton, now will you tell me what I have gotten into? I have a feeling Bishop Arne will not like it.
So, I told him.
Tom and Judy added the details, the mystery, the folk tales, the hints and fragmentary evidence. Heinrich nodded as he listened and asked an occasional question. Tom's explanation of hypospace physics confused him, I think, but then he was getting it second hand. I think Tom was confused as well. Sharon lived in a different world than we, an austere world and strangely beautiful, but one whose beauty we could at best only dimly grasp. Sharon had seen the likeness of a circuit in a manuscript illumination. Let it go at that. Her insight had given Tom the courage to test his intuition, and his intuition had sent her groping down a path that might, one day, give us the stars. Surely God moves in mysterious ways. Heinrich accepted it all quietly. How could he doubt when he had held the skull in his own hands? He looked out into the surrounding forest. There will be the remainder of the skeleton, of course, he said, pointing into the grave with the stem of his pipe, and of others as well. You say there were several of these beings, and out there? The pipe stem swept the black forest. Out there? What? Shards of metal, or plastic, rotted or decomposed beneath the living soil. He sighed.
There is much work to be done, and don't forget the cries of fraud or hoax that will be raised. We will need to bring others up here. Tell Bishop Arne and the university people.
No! We all looked at Judy in surprise.
She still held Johann's skull in her hands, and Gus, his initial fright over, was peering at it curiously, eyeball to eye socket. I was proud of the way our two workmen had reacted. Whatever was to come of all this, it boded well. "You know what they'll do, don't you?" she said. "They'll dig him up and wire him together and hang him behind bulletproof plastic so tourists can gawk at him and children make nasty jokes and laugh. It isn't right. It isn't." When she shook her head, her whole body shook. "That's not true, Judy," Tom said, gently putting his hands on her shoulders. She twisted her head around and gazed up at him. "Let them gawk, and let them joke," he said. "Oh, we'll take measurements and holographs and chip off some cells for the biologists to wonder at. That much he would have wanted. Then we'll make plaster casts and hang those. But him we'll keep safe from harm. And someday, when Sharon's work is done, someday, we'll find out where he came from and take him home. Or our children's children will." Heinrich nodded, his pipe sending filigrees of smoke toward the sky. Sepp stood in the pit, leaning on his shovel. He had his hands folded over the top of the shaft, looking up where the stars shone through the canopy of trees. And his face was a mixture of wonder and anticipation, the like of which I have never seen. O happy posterity, who will not experience such abysmal woe, and will look upon our testimony as a fable. Petrarch. Historical Notes. I've tried to depict the milieu of the mid-14th century Rhineland as accurately as possible, but that is difficult enough to do for early 21st century America, let alone a time and place where the world view was so different from our own categories of thought. For one thing, they took Christianity seriously, in many ways more seriously than modern Bible thumpers. At the same time, they took it more matter-of-factly. It was Christendom. But the first stirrings of the nationalism that was to destroy it were being felt. At Crecy and elsewhere, it had begun to matter which nation or race you were. Philosophers studied nature with virtually no intrusions by theologians, who were themselves natural philosophers. Natural philosophy formed the basic undergraduate curriculum, along with logic and the exact sciences of mathematics, astronomy, optics, statics, and music. Art and humanities were not taught. Doctors of theology, medicine, and law had first to master this curriculum. Never before or since has such a large proportion of a population been educated so exclusively in logic, reason, and science. Key was the concept of secondary causation. God had endowed material bodies with the ability to act upon one another by their own natures, hence natural laws. If God made the entire world, then invoking God to explain the rainbow or magnetism or rectilinear motion added nothing to human understanding. Philosophers therefore sought natural explanations to natural phenomena. That a later century would evoke religion over a trivial matter of the earth's motion would likely have astonished them. With two notable exceptions, the historical events and personages mentioned in the text were as described. The likeness of Margaret Multash, the ugly Duchess of Tyrol, was used to portray the Queen of Hearts in Alice in Wonderland. The Markgraf Friedrich mentioned in the text was Friedrich III, who ruled in Baden, not his cousin Friedrich IV, who ruled at the same time in Pforzheim. The months in which the Black Death struck various cities and regions were compiled by Peter Robin Rasmussen in an atlas at www.scholiast.org/history/blackdeath/index.html. Marzelvia really did refuse to take his army through the Hohenthal, using the excuse quoted. The overthrow of the Strasbourg town council and the Friday the 13th massacre of the Jews were described in the Chronicles of Strasbourg. Duke Albert and King Casimir did offer their realms as sanctuaries to the Jews, and the guild militias did assemble and defend the Jewish quarter of Regensburg. As in any age, there were wicked men and good. The story of the Fellberg demon is recorded in the annals of St. Blasia. The argument for natural rights of people against their prince was advanced by William of Ockham in his Opus Nonaginta Dierum, and earlier by Aquinas in On Kingship. Ockham determined and incepted, but never took a doctorate. He was last heard of when he left Munich on 10 March 1349 to make his peace with the Pope. The date on his Denkmal in Munich is incorrect, as we know from documents that he was alive after that point.